Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 17th of August. From 2002 to 2007, out of every $3 of national income growth, the top 1% of earners captured two. America, according to an analysis of the economy in 2005 from three Citigroup analysts, is composed of two distinct groups, the rich and the rest. And for the purposes of investment decisions, the second group doesn't matter. They are tracking its spending habits or worrying over its savings rate. All of that was a waste of time. All the action in the American economy has been at the top. The richest 1% of households earning as much each year as the bottom 60%. This is an amazing statistic. The richest 1% of households earning as much each year as the bottom 60% put together. We're going to talk about the middle class this hour of the program. The Atlantic has put together their entire September issue on the subject of the middle class. And our guest is the author of Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Don Peck is the features editor at The Atlantic and is our guest this hour to talk about his writing and to talk about the middle class. And I have a feeling we'll be just flooded with phone calls on this issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hello, Don. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. You know, you read some of those sentences and you just stop and say, oh, my goodness. You just can't say very much. I mean, we have to. We're on the radio, but it's just astounding.
It really is. The extent to which wealth has become concentrated at the top of American society is astounding. And, you know, that didn't seem to be such a big problem when it seemed like everyone was getting ahead. But one thing we've learned with the collapse of the housing bubble was that that bubble masked a lot of problems. You know, wage growth, well, there was no wage growth, you know, for middle-class Americans throughout the aughts. And the middle class has actually been hollowing due to technological developments and offshoring for years. As long as people's house prices were going up, those trends were sort of masked, but they aren't anymore. And in the wake of the recession, what we've seen is actually an acceleration of that hollowing and recovery really only at the top of society.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the article about America being in the state we find ourselves in now twice before during the Gilded Age and the Roaring Twenties. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, inequality has waxed and waned throughout American history. But it is interesting that at moments where it has been really extreme in the past, we've seen really large financial crises. You know, that the Panic of 1893, which marked the end of certain important aspects of the Gilded Age, the Roaring Twenties culminating in the crash of 1929 and the Depression, and high inequality before this crash in 2008. You know, and many economists are now beginning to look more closely at the relationship between inequality and particularly a lack of forward progress in the middle of society and its relationships to financial crashes. You know, one thing that clearly happened before 2008 and happened in those prior cases was the middle class struggled in part by taking on more debt, installment loans in the case of the 1920s, to kind of keep up with the rich, to preserve the idea that they were moving ahead as society was growing. Mm. But of course that proves unsustainable in the long run.
Mm-hmm. The educated among us, does it make any difference? Now, you keep hearing, well, the way to get yourself out of all of this, to be able to make a living, to support your family, is to go to school. You got to go to school. School has never been more important. You look at the well-educated among us and how they have fared in this great recession. Are they doing better than others?
They definitely are. The unemployment rate for people with professional degrees is about 2% in the U.S. For people with four-year college degrees, it's just a touch over 4%. Of course, the national rate is over 9%, and for people with only a high school degree or for high school dropouts, it's much, much higher. So yes, education still a good idea, still matters. It's true that you know, college that bachelor's degrees, the return on that investment is still very high, near a historic high. It's also true, though, that a college degree is not the sort of protection that it used to be against job loss, against kind of career volatility. In many ways, professional degrees, advanced degrees, now offer the sorts of predictable wage growth and security that college degrees used to offer. And so I think there are a lot of, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners who are college graduates are feeling insecure right now. I'm sure a lot of your listeners who have college degrees have lost their jobs and have had a hard time finding another job. We need to accelerate the rate of growth in the U.S. economy. You know, we need to support the recovery more strongly so people of all educational levels can get back to work. But the real crisis, the real problem, has been for people without college degrees.
Right. And you cite this statistic, and I want you to detail it. Since the year 2000, U.S. manufacturing has shed about one-third of its jobs. Did they all go overseas, or did they just become obsolete jobs? What?
It's a combination of job losses to China and perhaps even more so just technological substitution. You know, machines, you know, robots make goods, and increasingly robots make robots now. So you know, the fact is, even despite that one-third decline in employment and manufacturing, you know, the U.S. remains a very large global manufacturer. We're second in the world in manufacturing. You know, we're also third in the world as a farming nation, yet only 2% of Americans make their living as farmers. So it appears that manufacturing is kind of going the way of farming. We'll see some recovery in manufacturing jobs as the economy rebounds, but I don't expect that we'll see a lot. And more generally, you know, we clearly are seeing the rapid erosion of manufacturing as a substantial provider of jobs. We haven't adjusted to that as a nation. It's been a real problem for the non-professional middle class, especially for non-professional men, you know, who used to find secure livings in those jobs and in construction when the bubble was still blowing, and those men, those people are really, really struggling right now.
Yeah, Milwaukee is a case in point. We used to have lots of manufacturers based here, and people had family supporting jobs and strong unions, and whoa, that's all gone.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, we're seeing that all across the country, and you know, it's something, you know, we saw. What's interesting is, you know, people have this perception that manufacturing has been in kind of long decline since the 70s, and it's true that, like, as a percentage of the economy, it has been in decline, but the actual number of manufacturing jobs was really remarkably steady from about 1970 through 2000. It hovered around 17, 18, 19 million workers, and so manufacturing wasn't providing many new opportunities for a growing population, but you know, there were still a lot of jobs, nonetheless, in manufacturing. And as you've said, I mean, what we've seen in the last decade is very different. It's been a relentless decline in the absolute number of jobs in manufacturing in the U.S. And we're seeing, you know, we're beginning to see real social consequences from that.
In the part of your article in which you look at the troubles of the non-professional middle class, you quote an economist at MIT saying that the real median wages of men have fallen by 32% since their peak in 1973. That's incredible.
It's astonishing, and again, it reflects, I think, the real troubles that you know, families and couples and people without a college degree have had over the past 30 or 40 years. You know, a lot of men, you know, as outside work and blue collar work has declined in the economy, you know, men really haven't responded as a group by going to college more. The graduation rate for men from college is about the same as what it was in 1980 today. And they haven't really responded at the bottom of the economy and in the middle of the economy by loading into the service sector, sectors like education and healthcare, which have been growing. Those sectors remain dominated by women. And what a lot of men have done instead is just drop out of the workforce. In 1967, among high school graduates in their prime working years, 97% of American men were working. Today, that number is 76%. Mm. You've been seeing, as we've moved to a post-industrial economy, a meaningful minority of men have not adapted well and have really been struggling. And, that doesn't just have consequences for paychecks and bank accounts. Those kinds of struggles have an impact on families and family structure and the whole character of life in many communities.
So what are the prospects right now for those men who are less skilled?
Well, right now they're not good, and I fear that, what we've seen in this recession. So David Autor, an economist at MIT, has looked at the structure of job losses in this economy, and what he found was that overwhelmingly, by far, the most number of jobs lost were what economists call middle-skill jobs, and these are jobs in manufacturing, jobs in non-managerial office work as well, the kinds of jobs that people with high school degrees but not college degrees, have typically found that enable them to live middle-class lives. What we're seeing as we start to get a little bit of job growth, though very little right now, is that the jobs that are growing now are really at the bottom of the economy. They're jobs at $14 an hour or less in security and food preparation and the like. So I think we've got a lot of people who are really struggling terribly and are not likely to regain their past livelihood. I think we need to do more to help those people adjust and to help support them in the years ahead.
Yeah, and it's hard to believe. You talk about the wealthy among us. It's as though the Great Recession never happened. They've bounced back very nicely, thank you.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why we see this sort of lack of urgency in Washington today. It's true, when you look at just the geographic pattern of the recession and the recovery, the sort of power cities and creative enclaves into which the most educated, most highly skilled Americans have kind of flooded over the past two decades, New York, Manhattan especially, D.C., the Bay Area, Austin, Minneapolis as well. I mean, these places didn't experience the sorts of problems, even in the depth of the recession, that middle-class meccas like Phoenix and Las Vegas and Tampa did, and they have recovered faster. The housing didn't go down as much, and it's been coming back up in many of these markets. Wage growth has been very strong in Manhattan and in Silicon Valley. Meanwhile, the middle class remains remarkably troubled. Most middle-class wealth is held in housing, and housing hasn't recovered in most of the country, and a lot of people have been experiencing wage cuts. So I think there's a real disconnect between many of the places where the most influential and powerful Americans live, and what's happening in the rest of the country. That's very dangerous right now, and I fear that it will cause this weak period to linger much, much longer than it needs to.
Shame on them. They are to represent all of us, and you get the feeling, I know it's not entirely true, but that they all move in the same circles, and they all come from Wall Street into government, and they're all doing just fine, thank you, and they don't have, as you say, much of a perspective of what's going on with people who are losing their jobs or who are struggling or who haven't found their place since the manufacturing jobs left. There's a whole world out there that people, understandably, are frustrated that they don't think their government representatives are understanding.
Right, right. And I live in Washington, D.C., and I can tell you that You know, I meet with a lot of government officials, elected officials, policymakers. You know, and they all—I mean, they all intellectually understand what's going on, and they all regret what's happened. But you do, you know, you get the sense, and it's you get the sense across the aisle that. You know, a lot of people think that the recovery is simply more advanced than it actually is, and a lot of people just don't see, you know, I don't see in my daily life, you know, in the professional communities of Washington, you just don't see that many people struggling. You know, people seem to be doing just fine, and I'm sure that has shaped the reaction to this crisis. When you think about it, you know, the government was very focused on job creation and on, you know, aggressive action early in 2009 until the stock market bounced. And, you know, we've had a few days of volatility recently, but the stock market has mostly recovered, and in many ways the government has become less focused on jobs, right. At least in its actions, if not its words, since that happened.
Yeah, and less focus on looking at the tax system. And we need people like Warren Buffett to write articles in the New York Times saying, I'm taxed at 17 point whatever percent. I'm making billions of dollars. Tax me more. We're looking at people like that to raise the issue. Tax me.
I know. It's kind of crazy, isn't it?
It is kind of crazy. We have all kinds of people who want to speak with you, John. And we will, of course, talk about the economy, and Don writes in his piece that it's not just a matter of jolting the economy back onto its former path, it's about changing the path. Well, that's a big thing for us to explore, and we'll do that in a moment. Don Peck is features editor for The Atlantic Magazine, author of Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't know how many of you remember the interview we did with Lieutenant Governor Jefferson Keel from the Chickasaw Nation, who is in town because he's vice president of the Native American Association. Wonderful man, just smart and beautiful to look at, dignified, and sent us chocolate from the Chickasaw Nation. They're making spectacular chocolate there. And during that interview, he said, you know, we were talking about climate issues, and he said, you need to do a show about how climate warming is affecting Native peoples and the villages in Alaska that are falling into the ocean. And we said, yes, we do need to do a show on that. And so we're going to do a show on that, and that's tomorrow during this hour. Kivalina, a climate change story. Christine Shearer will talk about those small villages that are falling into the ocean because it's too hot. So that's tomorrow at 10. Don Peck is our guest now. 800-486-8655 is our number. Steve is our first caller from Monaco. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I'm wondering if your guest has any ideas of how maybe the media could help educate people of the population that the employers are not the enemy. So many politicians, you know, it's fashionable for them to make everybody envy the successful people and want to steal more money from the job creators. I know that the so-called rich people and corporations do pay over half the taxes, but I'm wondering why do politicians constantly always try to blame our problems on people that have done well?
Well, that's a good question, Stephen. You know, I mean, I don't know that politicians always try to do that, but I mean, I think there has been an element of that. I mean, President Obama has taken some jabs at fat cats on Wall Street, certainly, and I think, you know, to a large degree, that's unfair. I think we should continue to celebrate great accomplishments in work. You know, ultimately, entrepreneurs and kind of new firms are extremely important to job growth in the U.S. And a lot of the things that businesses have been doing, they have to do. I mean, offshoring, technological substitution. These are pressures on. These are kind of deep forces, and they are significant pressures on business, and business really has to respond. I don't think that that a more progressive tax system, that higher taxes for the rich, can by any means solve all of America's problems. And in my book, Pinched, I try to lay out an array of solutions ranging from things that can help increase the rate of technological breakthroughs to different ways of educating young people that can help them move into the middle class more aggressively. However, I do think that a more progressive tax system, as Warren Buffett himself has recently written, should be a part of the solution. You know, tax rates have fallen consistently on the highest earners over the past half century as we've oriented our society in a way that has enabled the best educated, the most skilled, the most entrepreneurial to maximize their incomes, to win more and more of the national income. We've reduced taxes on them, expected less of them, year by year. The top marginal tax rate was something like 90% in the 50s. It was something like 50% at the end of the 70s. It's just come down and down and down since then. I do think that particularly at a time when the American middle class is hollowing, you know, when people need more support, that we need to find some money, you know, somewhere to do that, and I do think that the top of American society could pay more and should pay more than it is paying today.
What about his point that corporations are paying 50% of the taxes in this country? Is that true?
I don't remember exactly how he phrased his point, but I don't believe that corporations are paying anything near 50% of the total taxes, government revenues. If you look at total government revenues, no, I don't think corporations are paying anything like that.
Next to Mike in Sheboygan. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I was just curious about one of the silver linings, potentially, depending on which side of the fence you're on, is the number of people that have been out of work for some time and have decided that the only way they're going to keep a roof over their head is to go into business for themselves. And I was in that position. I was in upper management here about 2 years ago, well, a little bit more now. And I found myself out of work for about a year, year and a half, and I was shocked by it. There had always been a demand for what I did. And eventually just a lot of soul searching. Midlife crisis, I suppose, and I made that decision to go into business, and it's moderately successful. But what I've been shocked by is how many other people are in the exact have made the exact same decision. Our houses are totally underwater, and it's a serious situation. But I don't believe it's totally hopeless, and I think it's actually pretty fascinating that people have found themselves kicked out of the system and are fighting their way back in ways that otherwise they would never have been compelled to do. In other words, pulling yourself up, by the bootstraps.
What are you doing, Mike? Why did you start? What kind of business?
I have an arts background, and so I do stone carving, I do polished concrete.
Oh.
And things like that.
Uh-huh.
It's a niche market, but I sell nationwide now, selling overseas.
Good for you.
But it's a struggle. It's a struggle. But, my mortgage, I make that payment every month, and I work almost 7 days a week. But my family's got food on the table. And, and I got to say, just in absolute humility, the state, in terms of, kind of a little bit embarrassed about, but in terms of Badger Care, my family's on Badger Care. But I'm working to grow a business where I can employ other people and I can support my own family.
Yeah.
I would say that I think that's worth saying that that thin safety net that our society has here in Wisconsin really is critical to people having the opportunity to take that risk and trying to grow businesses and try to grow this economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Mike makes a lot of great points, and he said something very, very important, which is it's not hopeless. That when we look at the effects that periods like this one have on American society, they're really complex, and a lot of them are negative, but not all of them. If you look at the 1930s, for instance, it was actually one of the periods of the fastest technological growth in U.S. history. And what we find is that what economists have found is that typically in recessions, you do begin to see bursts of entrepreneurialism as we recover from them, because people are thrown out of work and they need to find something new to do. Because people that might have been stifling in a corporate bureaucracy, need to find something else to do and explore ideas that were otherwise being stifled. So one result of periods like this, once the recovery is underway, is sometimes a burst of entrepreneurialism and a burst of growth. And I hope that will happen this time around. I think there are two things towards that are really important. One is it's great news that Mike has found at least some success with his venture, with his new venture. Demand in general right now is so depressed in the U.S. Consumers just can't spend. They're rebuilding their balance sheets from a decade of debt. Most people really, even most people who have tried new entrepreneurial ventures who are kind of trying to be free agents, in my reporting and in the aggregate statistics, really are still struggling. So I think it's the wrong time to be turning towards government austerity. I think we need to continue to offer some government support, some government demand as consumers rebuild their portfolios. But the other thing that we really need to do, in fact, is to support technological progress, to support small entrepreneurs as they're trying to launch new businesses, and that involves a lot of things that we're not doing right now, from greater support for R&D and scientific advance, just financially, to a really an entirely different way of looking at regulation, and especially the regulation of small businesses and small industries, which can provide bursts of job growth and new jobs as the economy recovers.
Mm-hmm. That they're overly regulated, you're saying, or what are you saying about regulation?
Many are. I mean, the financial crisis, I think, shows us that not all industries were overregulated in the aughts. The financial industry certainly wasn't. But there has been an accretion of regulations over the past decade related to the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, related to Sarbanes-Oxley. And I think these things have chilled the investment environment to some extent. More than just regulatory balance is always difficult in practice, but more than specific regulations, the economist Mike Mandel has made a great suggestion, I think, which is we really need to look at the way we regulate businesses differently. Right now, there are dozens of different departments in the U.S. government that are aimed at regulating some aspect of a business. There's nothing that looks strategically at the net effect of all these regulations in total, and particularly for young sectors, like the internet was really in the 90s. So green technology, social media, wireless platforms today. We really, particularly for those sectors that could grow hugely and provide a lot of job growth, we should be looking strategically at them, and our bias should be towards light regulation, especially early in their growth when they're still forming and when they can be really explosive to help the economy.
Boyd is next. Thanks, Mike, for your call, and best of luck to you. Boyd in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi,
hello, your guests. This is a very, very good show. You bring up some good points. I got a number of things, so I'll try and be brief. First off, on Tom Ashbrook last night, they talked about a very similar subject to what your guest is bringing up in terms of joblessness and how it's becoming a much more alarming factor. And we're seeing the flat-out disappearance of the middle class. A book I'm currently reading, and this came out in the late 80s, early 90s, it's called America, What Went Wrong by Donald Bartlett and James Steele. And if you fast forward it to now, I think a lot of what they're saying, from a personal opinion, it's not as bad as what they were saying. I think it's actually a lot worse. I think, there needs to be a government. When you hear, like, for instance, Rick Perry saying, calling for more smaller government, we need to have something that is where the government is going to get back to being a regulator and push for small businesses, and also to help states keep businesses within their states. For big business, you know, we all know big business is always going to do what's best for big business, where small businesses are more focused on the community and trying to keep jobs within the community. I could go on and on, but I think I'll leave it at that and take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Boyd. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Boyd. I mean, you know, local businesses, small businesses are extremely important to the economy, and we need to find ways to make sure that we're supporting them and allowing them to grow. You know, the lending environment right now is still pretty tight. Big corporations are flush with cash and seem to have little trouble, you know, getting loans from banks. Small businesses, that's much less the case. We're still really feeling the after effects of the financial crisis in that sense. And bank lending that can support job growth for small firms has been low. And we need to find ways to address that soon.
Why is it that so many of these companies have made huge profits? It's all mixed up in my mind. And they're sitting on this money. I mean, don't they feel some level of social responsibility to create jobs, to do innovations? And why just sit on a bunch of money when there are a lot of people who aren't doing very well?
Well, I mean, I think that ultimately, you know, the way many corporations have increased profits so much has been through cost cutting, and they've ruthlessly restructured operations, which has allowed them to kind of produce the same amount of goods with fewer workers. And again, it's been largely non-professional middle class people who've been hurt the most by that. I mean, that's really been the source of their profit growth, and I think the main reason they're not investing is simply that the economy remains really weak. They're not seeing signs of increasing demand. You know, consumers still remain really indebted, and until that changes, they just don't have much incentive to invest. So they could invest out of social responsibility, you're right, but you know, they aren't. They're by and large, their responsibility does ultimately lie with their shareholders and their bottom line. And again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, because I don't think this is a permanent solution, and it's not really the solution to the long-term problems of the middle class. But when consumers can't spend, it becomes all the more important for the government to step in, increase investment in things like infrastructure, which can create jobs directly for the millions of construction workers and manufacturing workers who've lost their jobs, increase aid to states so that those states can keep employing teachers and police and firefighters, and kind of provide both jobs and cash to local economies that can help support demand as the private sector recovers, as consumers pay down their debt and put themselves in a position to be able to spend again. You know, the debt is a large problem in the U.S. today, and we need to be taking aggressive and binding actions to reduce the debt, you know, once the economy is healthy again. But it's really the wrong time, dead wrong, to be moving towards austerity and immediate deficit reduction. That's not going to help business confidence. It's going to hurt it.
Reed from Clintonville. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Say a couple of things quickly, just a very short story. But first, let me say, if corporations and the wealthy are paying 50% of the taxes in this country, it's because 50% of the people in this country are unemployed and cannot pay any taxes. That said, many of us out here in the middle class and lower class are now have another brick in the middle of the road. Paul Ryan, for instance, our congressman down in the southern part of the state, is now charging us to speak to him about issues concerning jobs. And here's my short story. I had an appointment with Congressman Reed Ribble, our 8th District congressman. I was told that that was canceled. Until I said to the office, well, then I'll just be out front with my sign and my whistle when Congressman Ribble is here. because I wanted to speak to him about jobs, our son being unemployed since January 3rd, and many other individuals that I know that are unemployed have been looking for jobs for months. And when I did sit down with Congressman Ribble, both he and Senator Ron Johnson ran as small businessmen who knew how to create jobs. And I was just given lip service as to jobs. And they are so out of touch with what we out here in the hinterlands of the Midwest and the Rust Belt of the Midwest are going through. These men have no idea the troubles that people are experiencing.
John.
No, I agree. And, you know, I think that, you know, there was an opinion survey that that Gallup just did that showed that Washington, D.C. is by far the most optimistic city in the country.
Is it really?
As to the current state and future of the economy. And you know, it does go to this division, you know, that we're seeing, you know, where really there are kind of a few islands of affluence right now that are doing just fine. And to some extent, they are simply kind of emotionally insulated from the real pain in the rest of the economy. The thing that I think exacerbates that is it's very natural. You know, I note this in Pinched, my book. It's very natural in after busts to become, you know, very sort of personally conservative, very money conscious, and very concerned about the national debt. You know, we saw that in the early 80s, where a majority of Americans thought that the debt was going to choke off recovery. They were intensely worried about that, even though the debt was much lower than it is today. We saw it in 1936, and it caused the government to cut spending, raise taxes at the wrong time, you know, and that caused unemployment to spike back up again. So this combination of kind of the geographic pattern of where people live today, and I think that the natural psychology of busts has really caused policymakers in D.C. to take their eye off the ball and to you know, worry more about the debt, say, than job creation. We need to reverse that. We need to reverse it strongly. And I think, you know, all of your listeners, you know, we all need to tell our politicians, write letters, call them, tell them that we are not happy with the direction that our government is leading us in right now, and that it needs to change.
Let's talk for a few moments about the larger global economy. You spend time in the article looking at this, and you say that we can't wish away globalization or turn our backs on trade. It would be crippling and impoverishing. America's prosperity is tied to globalization, but something has nonetheless gone wrong with the way America's economy has evolved in response to increasingly dense global connections.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I if you look at the last 10 or 15 years, globalization has sped up in many ways, and with it, so too has the spread of information. And, you know, America has placed its bets on continual innovation for 20 or 30 years now. We've accepted the idea that, you know, older industries will allow jobs to move overseas, will allow them to be usurped by technology, will make up the difference by continually innovating and creating new industries, new products, new jobs. But those innovations diffuse faster than they used to, and faster even than they did in the 90s. And in fact, the aughts, for various reasons, saw a very low rate of breakthrough innovations to begin with. So, you know, one way that we need to adapt as a country is we really need to double down on our investment in research, new technologies, not process innovations, but the kinds of new technologies that can create whole new industries, whole new products. You know, I call in my book for a sort of Manhattan Project to do that. The other thing we need to do by way of adaptation, though, is we need to recognize that no matter how quickly the economy grows, there are a large number of people in the middle of society that are facing and will continue to face real pressure because of technological substitution, because of offshoring, and we need to do two things for them. You know, we need to start helping them build more pathways from high school kind of into the middle class for people who don't go to college. We should support college education. We should grow it. But, you know, we also need the sorts of alternative pathways that Germany, for instance, has successfully developed to help teenagers who might not be right for college nonetheless build skills, see real careers, and find them. The second thing we need to do, and this does it gets back to taxation, is I think we need to accept the fact that for the foreseeable future, you know, a large number of people in the U.S., as these middle-skill jobs hollow, are going to need to take work in lower-paying fields that have, you know, jobs that have not traditionally been middle-class jobs. And, you know, I think part of the idea of being an American is offering a social compact to people who are working, who, you know, to provide dignity for work. And I think we need to start subsidizing the wages of low-wage workers to make their jobs more like middle-class jobs in the future. I think that's something that ultimately is very American.
More phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour is Don Peck. He's written, actually, it's the whole September issue of The Atlantic that looks at the middle class and what's happened to the middle class and looks at all these related issues of globalization and historical comparisons to other times in American history. It talks about the concentration of wealth and those who are doing well and why that's happening and what's happened to middle-class jobs and manufacturing jobs and what road from here. Don Peck is features editor of The Atlantic and author of Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Future and What We Can Do About It. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our next caller is Jerry in La Crosse. Hi, Jerry. Oh, Jerry is gone. I'm so sorry. We go next to Bonita in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. Yeah, the reason I'm calling, I've always had, for the last few years, this idea. You know that magazine, Consumer Reports?
Sure.
Why don't we have a magazine or a computer program called the Corporation Reports? And as consumers, we can choose which corporations we buy from. We don't have to support corporations that pay ridiculous wages in China. We can support corporations that treat workers across the world better. And that way we're not pitting the workers of one country against the workers of another. We're pitting corporate behavior, the way corporations behave against each other. That way we can protect the workers, the environment, the animals, whatever. By pitting corporations against each other and buying from the corporations, we think behave in the way we want them to.
John.
I think it's an interesting idea, and you know, I think some companies do kind of tout their, you know, made in America and the like. You know, it's very interesting. So I was at the Aspen Ideas Festival last summer, which is kind of a colloquy for the rich and the powerful, and a lot of business executives and entrepreneurs are there each year, and kind of, you know, the sense I had was that, you know, this period in many ways globally has been all about the rise of the middle class, just not ours. And corporate executives are very kind of ambivalent. You know, they view themselves as a part of a global elite. They have global markets. They have a global workforce. And, you know, one executive said, well, you know, if when you think about it, if we're offshoring and that's lifting three people out of poverty and into the middle class in China, and one American in the middle class falls out of the middle class as a result, that's not such a bad trade. So I mean, I think that's very much kind of the attitude of a lot of rich, powerful business executives right now. And really, I mean, looking at humanity broadly, I mean, they you know, I guess they have a point, but that's cold comfort to most Americans. And I think one thing that at a minimum we need to recognize is that the interests of corporate executives, America's companies, America's entrepreneurs, you know, they're not necessarily aligned in the same ways with the interests of the workforce and the interests of the country, you know, that they were in previous decades, because the workforce is global, because demand is global. Now, that doesn't mean that executives are bad people. It doesn't mean that that they have bad motives. But I mean, I think it does mean that we need to be skeptical at times that the policies, for instance, that that corporate executives and business leaders are advocating and pursuing are automatically and necessarily going to be the same policies that are actually best for American workers.
Thanks, Benita, for the call. Rebecca in Platteville, hi.
Hi. During the last election with Johnson and Feingold, Johnson kept saying that out of the Senate, 70 of them were lawyers. And Feingold retorted and said that 70 of them were millionaires, and Johnson was just yet another one. And that got me thinking, I don't know what the ratio is now in the Senate on millionaires. I don't care, Democrat, Republican. But what is also the ratio in the House, considering if they are supposed to, the millionaires are supposed to be like 2% of the population, and yet I can do my math well enough in the Senate, that's 70%. How are they representing us?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know the percentage breakdowns, but it is true that an overwhelming percentage of Congress people and senators do have a law degree, which I think makes them naturally combative and argumentative, perhaps, and less apt to try to find compromise. And yes, on average, both members of the Senate and members of the House are quite wealthy. There are many exceptions, but yes, they are before they became elected, they were typically doing quite a lot better than most Americans, and they've got years of lobbying, lucrative lobbying or law practice after they retire from public service to look forward to as well. So I do think that shapes the way that they look at things. To some extent, this was always true. I mean, our elected representatives have typically come from the upper reaches of society. So I don't know that this is a big change, but certainly culturally, there's been more of a separation. There's been more of a geographic separation. Fewer of our elected officials served in the military, than used to be the case, and are kind of cut off from much of the rest of society in that respect too. So I do think, and I write about this in Pinch, that we're seeing a really important and worrying separation in American society between the powerful and the rich and just about everyone else. And I think we need to find ways to address that in the long run.
Mm-hmm. And just briefly, we're almost out of time, and this is way too big a question to ask you, and I'm sorry, but when you talk about a recovery happening, just give me some guidelines of what actions need to be taken to spark some kind of economic recovery.
Right. In the short run, the most important thing, I believe, is an aggressive push towards more government support, more government stimulus, direct job creation. Our infrastructure is deteriorating. We've been underinvesting for years. I think we should have a huge push to rebuild our infrastructure. That would put laid-off construction workers, manufacturing workers to work directly. I think the government should find other ways to kind of inject cash into the economy as well. These things are very important in the short run to bolster demand, keep people working, create new jobs as consumer finances recover. We need to pair that with long-term debt reduction, but right now we need a more active government role in creating jobs directly and putting cash in consumers' pockets so they can pay down debt more quickly. In the longer run, in the medium run, we need to support technological development and technological innovation in ways that we haven't so far. Part of the answer there is regulatory. You know, and part of the answer is greater support for R&D and for scientific advance. And we need finally to begin. And this is more of a long-term thing. You know, we need to begin to support people who haven't gone to college, high school graduates who are falling out of the middle class, by helping them retrain more aggressively, by providing new skills, and simply by providing subsidies for, you know, the jobs frequently at Walmart that they are finding, and for people in their 50s, 60s, you know, that may be all they can find, you know, for the rest of their working careers. If we do all of these things, and these are very big things, and I'm skimming quickly through them, you know, we can make a difference. We can end this period faster and put ourselves on firmer footing for the future.
Mm. Don, thank you. You are just a wonderful guest. There's so much here, isn't there? There's so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Don Peck, features editor of The Atlantic Magazine. He is author of Pinched, How the Great Recession Has Narrowed Our Futures and What We Can Do About It. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease. Chrissy Pease producing the show and doing on-air production. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Sorry we didn't get to all of them. We were flooded. Go to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We're going to have the books from the first hour up sometime soon.